and welcome to episode 14 of Cop and Daughter. I'm Cop.
And I'm Daughter.
So in this episode, we are discussing the true story of the abduction and murder of Ann Harrison. We learned about this, or we learned the details of this through a book called By the Side of the Road. It was written by Marla Bernard, who was a detective with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. I got the book off of Amazon. You can go directly to the publisher's website of wildbluepress.com. But yeah, so I do not recall this story at all. It did happen in the summer of 1989 when I was 18. I don't know that I was paying much attention to what was going on in the world at that time, although Richard Grissom was the same summer. So that clearly something I did recall from that, but this I did not. So everything that we know that we're going to discuss in this podcast comes from what we read in the book By the Side of the Road. So let's just start there. Let's start with the book. What did you think of the book?
It was not what I expected. I was kind of expecting a story about the events of the crime and what took place. And it ended up being more of a like a quick snapshot of what took place in the crime. And then I felt like it spent more time talking about like the background of the two criminals that were involved in the crime and their trial cases more than anything. It was very like intellectual, or I don't know if that's the right word, but kind of felt like something you'd read like a textbook type of.
I mean, maybe intellectual. Like the word that comes to my mind is it was very sterile for. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's graphic in terms of what happened, but
yeah, academic was the word I was.
Would be good. Yeah, so I had the same sort of like, it reads more like a police report. I would even say it's what you would get. So. Leading up to a trial and trying a case, it's probably what you would get when you get a case file, because you're going to read multiple reports by multiple different people. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to read that same information over and over again. And some would be, you know, the narrative of a confession. You kind of try to clean it up and put it together for court. So yeah, I'm with you. I expected it to be more of a story. I expected there to be more kind of even information about the victim. I mean, there wasn't even like a 24 hours leading up to this. Like what? And I mean, she was a 15-year-old high school student, just turned 15. And so, so there was really no kind of backstory. We don't know much about the family, don't know much about her.
Right.
At all. And so, I don't think it's bad. I don't think the book is terrible. It's an fairly easy read. Mm-hmm. Neither one of us has read a lot of true crime.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe this is
I guess, our first book technically was In Cold Blood.
Right. Yeah.
But in terms of,
So what Truman Capote did with that was he wrote the first true crime novel. And so he, there was probably even an element of him embellishing the characters in that
a little bit.
That's actually a really good comparison, because you kind of get some history there, a sense of he lived with the people, he learned about the people, he learned about the community, you know, whether you agree with what he did or not. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is very academic, very sterile. It would be, I can't remember if I referred to it as a case study or not, but that would be another sort of like, like this kind of gives you what an investigation looks like, what a case file would look like. Mm-hmm. There are diagrams drawn in there.
Yeah.
There's pictures of the suspects. It very much is kind of like a case file put into a paperback. Mm-hmm. So any other thoughts that you had on that?
Not really.
Anything about the way the book read or anything that like surprised you at the way it was reported or anything like that?
There are several spots throughout the book where they like transcribe interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something for me that like, because they write them the way that they're grammatically spoken, which you can like push back on this, but the grammar was not great by the people being spoken. So I felt like it was hard a little bit to follow what was being said. Whereas like if I had been watching it on a video, I think you can kind of piece together or like follow something like that better. But yeah, because it was written grammatically incorrect, to keep it authentic,
yeah,
is a little bit hard to follow.
Yeah. So, and that's, I would say that that's true of just about any investigation. We don't talk the way books are written.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then he, one of the suspects, Taylor, he uses a lot of the, you know,
yeah.
And obviously when we're having a conversation with somebody, it can be annoying for somebody. Right. So it's like, you know, but it's even harder when you're trying to read between the lines of and understand like what the person is talking about, especially when they're describing things that they did. Mm-hmm. And places that they went and different things like that. So, all right. So I would say this, if this was my book, I would be proud of it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I'd be proud of the end product, but I think for both of us, it was not quite what we were expecting and have kind of gotten used to more of a narrative story and learning about the different people involved versus mm-hmm. it being just kind of a case file reading. So, all right. What do you want to kind of go tell us what happened, what the timeline is, what the story is?
Yeah. So Ann Harrison was a 15-year-old in Kansas. And do you have the date?
In Kansas City,
but the date of her abduction, it was 1989.
So it starts on March 22nd, goes kind of, well, March 22nd is the date that they give, so.
Yeah, so she lived in Kansas City, went to Raytown South High School, and on the morning of March 22nd, 1989, she walked to the end of the driveway to wait for the bus. And what I gathered from the story is, like, in the span of 6 minutes, she was abducted and taken away from her current location. And we later learned through kind of the background of the criminals that they were notorious for stealing women's purses. And so they initially like pulled up because they spotted the girl waiting on the side of the road with a purse. And so the two suspects are Richard Nunley
mm-hmm.
and then Michael Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
So Nunley drives the car. Taylor typically gets out and grabs the purse. So they pull the car up. Taylor gets out to go grab the purse, is asking Anne for fake directions, and then ditches the purse and takes Anne instead. And whether that was, I guess I'm going off of what they've said is in terms of like if their plan was originally to steal the purse or not. But so they abduct Anne and they take her to Nunley's mother's house near Grandview, I believe. And they... Oh, they're also in a stolen vehicle, a Chevrolet Monte Carlo. So they pull the car into the basement garage mm-hmm. of Richard's mom's house. And in the span of like an hour and a half, they abduct Anne, they rape her, and get her into the trunk of the car and then stab her to death. Is there anything I'm missing there? I think that
no,
is.
No, I think that's the general.
Yep. So then they close her in the trunk, drive the car about an hour and a half, not an hour and a half, half a mile from the murder location, leave the car and get into another stolen car and drive away. And I can't remember the exact timeline of when she's found, but she's found pretty soon after it all happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, this is like a person's worst, a parent's worst nightmare, a 15-year-old's worst nightmare. I mean, this is like, there are so many things that had to like kind of fall into place for this to happen, because they, I don't think, you know, regardless of what happened at the end moment, I don't believe they were out looking for somebody to, I mean, these guys were just, they were basically, this was probably their routine, was being up all night and stealing T-tops off of cars, stealing. Yeah.
Can you explain what a T-top is? I had to Google that.
I can explain. So generally T-tops are on a two-door car, and it's usually, I guess it could be any size car, but it's usually a two, well, it would be a two-door car. And basically it's a part of the roof that above the door, through the roof, about midway, that section of the roof could be taken out. And then there is a thin, like maybe 3 or 4 inch wide. I don't know. I guess it could be 5 inches, 6 inches. It could actually be wider than what I'm thinking is, but there's a narrow strip that goes between the front of the roof and the back of the roof. And so on just above the doors on either side of the roof are these panels that can be removed. Mm-hmm. And then there's the bar in between. So it's kind of like almost like the opposite of what like a sunroof or a moonroof is.
Right.
And the T-tops were very popular.
And so they would remove the panel part or that middle part?
That middle part doesn't come out.
Okay.
That middle part holds the car together. It's kind of like the structural part of the... So yeah, it was a very 70s feature to a car. They often leaked. They were often stolen. And so it's kind of interesting because that would have been the market for them in selling these things.
Right.
Was they're basically selling them to a car parts guy who's going to sell them to somebody that's had their T-top stolen.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the whole market for T-tops is we're stealing each other's, or a handful of criminals are stealing a bunch of different people's T-tops, and then they got to go and buy somebody else's T-tops to replace them. So, yeah, I mean, that was fairly common. I mean, you know, when we first moved to the Kansas City area, your grandpa was staying at a hotel until we moved down here, and he had the wheels stolen off of his Lincoln. His 1979 Lincoln had its wheels stolen while it was parked
I mean,
it was literally put up on like cinder blocks, and the wheels and the tires were taken. So,
oh my gosh.
I suppose to some degree it probably still happens, but
yeah,
it seemed to be more of like a 70s and an 80s type thing. And then that's like the other thing I think this kind of reminded me of. And so I don't want to gloss over or make light of the fact that we're talking about a 15-year-old who really, like I said, it was probably her worst nightmare, her parents' worst nightmare kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But I just don't think people comprehend that like criminals truly drive all night long and look for things to steal. And so much of it is really a crime of opportunity. And the one thing that I will never understand, and this, like, as a police officer, this happened quite frequently during summer, is a number of people that keep guns in their car and leave their car unlocked. And then the other thing that I would tell people not to do is if you have a valet key for your vehicle, do not leave the valet key in the glove box. Because that's the other thing that they do is they get into cars and they look in the glove box, and if the valet key is in there, well, then they can steal the car.
Right.
So, you know, just there are so many things that people just, you know, when you live in a world where that kind of stuff doesn't happen much, I think people think it's not going to happen. But the reality is criminals have nothing but time on their hands, especially when it's like an all night thing like that, where they're driving around getting stoned, looking for cars to steal, stereos, T-tops, that sort of thing. And that's what these two guys were doing. I mean, essentially they were just on an all night deal. And I really don't think that that was in their plan, was to, cause I think they would have had like equipment. They would have had, they would have been a little more prepared for it. So she's literally at the end of her driveway.
Yeah.
As a 15-year-old waiting for her school bus. I mean, again, people just don't think that kind of stuff happened. I mean, I would never have been concerned about that.
Right.
Even now, I mean, the chances of it happening. And then you, like you said, she was down there for maybe all of 6 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you and know, any number of things could have caused them to come later, have come earlier, or not come down her street at all.
Right. I even think, I might be remembering this wrong, but I think the mom could like see her from the kitchen window. So it wasn't like she was out of view
right.
of her house.
Yeah.
But it just that quickly was.
Yeah.
Yep.
It yeah. happened that fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So again, you know, I can't imagine being a 15-year-old girl. You're standing for your bus and now somebody's grabbed you and thrown you
yeah.
into the car.
Right.
And did they drive with her in the back seat?
No, or? She's like, the car had like a 3-seater situation uh-huh. in the front. And so they stuck her in the middle and mm-hmm. kind of like laid her over.
Gotcha.
And I think they like blindfolded her with a sock.
Yeah.
And at one point, one of the suspects told her, like, if you scream, I'll stab you with the screwdriver. So yeah. I think that was their way of keeping her quiet.
Yeah. And again, that to me just speaks to, you know, a screwdriver versus a knife or a gun. They tie her up with like stereo wire. They, you know, cover her eyes with a sock. They were not going out to go do this. They were just,
yep.
for whatever reason, one of them. And that was kind of the thing. So, like you said, they take them to a house, take her to a house. They drive into the basement, which is fairly common in the city in older houses that weren't built with garages, as they would excavate part of the yard.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in a house like that in Kansas City that where, I don't know if you remember that around back, we
yeah.
had the garage door that went yep. under the house. And so,
yep.
So that's that was a fairly common thing. But then even so they abduct her and then, they decide that they're going to rape her. And then even in that, the thing that I find is like sort of interesting is they decide to let her get dressed on her own.
Yeah.
And then they walk her out to the car. And like you said, they make her get in the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually didn't even have anything on them. And they went and got a couple of knives. And where did they go to get the knives?
They went upstairs to the mom's kitchen.
Yeah.
And he got a butcher knife and like a serrated,
is that how you said?
Serrated, yeah. like steak knife.
Yeah. So they have her get dressed. She gets in the trunk of her car. And then there's kind of some like throughout this whole thing, they clearly do this together.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are like blaming the other person for
instigating the killing,
instigating the rape, instigating yeah. the killing,
yeah,
that sort of thing. Honestly, I don't think you could really know based on what I read in there and even mm-hmm. like how they talk in their interviews. I'm going to say Nunley is probably more.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was.
The brains behind it and the decision maker. That doesn't mm-hmm. mean the other person couldn't have been impulsive. So. Yeah, so they go and get these two knives, they have her in the backseat of the car, and then they proceed to kill her. And how yeah. what kind of transpires with that?
So I think, well, we don't know for sure, but you can kind of assume that Nunley was the first to make a move with mm-hmm. the knife, and he had the bigger butcher knife and tried to kind of do like a clean cut.
Like slash her throat.
Slash her throat. But the knife was too dull. And so I thought it was I felt like the author of this book like emphasized this part a decent amount of times. But he then took the knife and just kind of plunged it into her throat, but then proceeded to like twist the knife.
Mm-hmm.
So making the wounds even more severe.
Yeah.
I can't remember the total number of stab wounds she was that were inflicted upon her, but there were multiple.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically died a slow death over the next, I think it was like 2.5 hours.
Yeah, so they said she was probably conscious for 15 and then
right
took her about 2 hours to bleed out.
Yeah. So she was just in the back of the trunk on the side of the road
mm-hmm.
bleeding out.
Yeah.
Until she died.
Yeah, and so that's kind of how all this starts, is in terms of the book and even the mm-hmm. police becoming involved, is they mm-hmm. go to deal with a stolen vehicle that's
yeah.
been abandoned on the street,
mm-hmm.
and they open up the trunk, and there's a dead body in there.
Right.
It's this dead Anne Harris, and Anne Harrison is deceased in the trunk of this car.
Yes.
And it's interesting because that is like I knew nothing of this case, but anytime you recovered a stolen car, you were always like, what am I going to find in the trunk?
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And really didn't happen all that. Well, almost never happened. Almost mm-hmm. never happened. But yeah, it does happen. So
yeah.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, he stabbed her in the neck and twisted it. And I think one of the things, so this is an example of this, is they find her. Well, she goes missing on the 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for her. And it's just kind of like, it's coincidence. They find right. her in the stolen car. It's
right.
They don't know it, but literally, 3 months later, Michael Taylor confesses to killing her.
Mm-hmm.
So like 90 days, the police do like good. Like this is just, again, I talk about good, solid police work.
Yeah.
And first of all, these guys are idiots.
Mm-hmm.
But the police do what they know they can do to find these guys.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a pattern of behavior.
Right. Oh, yeah. They made the connection of like, so they had multiple cars mm-hmm. that had the ashtray taken out, the dome light,
mm-hmm.
which is the light that like turns on when you open mm-hmm. the door. Those are ripped out. So they had these like their MOs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was like they found this car with those MOs and also Anne's body in the trunk.
Yeah.
And so they were able to use that to kind of connect the dots.
Yeah. And then ultimately they put out the reward on the tips hotline, gets up to like $9,000. Mm-hmm. And so do you remember the guy's name? I don't even remember his name. Anyway,
I think it's like Hurley or.
Yeah, I think it's Hurley. So they get Nunley's friend.
Yeah.
So it's Nunley's friend that he's basically known, probably done crimes with. Mm-hmm. Well, he not only tells him about knowing about what happened to Anne Harrison, he tells him about another homicide of Fat Charlie or something mm-hmm. like that. And this guy had done the same thing with Nunley.
Mm-hmm.
When Taylor was in prison, he would be the one that would jump out and steal the purse. And so there were a lot of different things that he knew about him, and he ultimately. So that was one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting about this book, is there seems to be a lot of these like sort of side stories, but I'm not really sure like that they add anything to the book.
Yeah.
So like they tell you a little bit about this Hurley guy mm-hmm. and his deal, and he ends up kind of getting life in prison for raping some gal spends
so
his $9,000 on
the lawyers.
Yeah. Yep. And then there's even a story about like some judge. I don't know if you made it that far.
Yeah. She basically was just saying like, because it took years for them to, basically like follow through with the sentencing of the two suspects. And, so she, you know, just makes a point of like, there was lots of tragedy within the people involved in the Anne Harrison case. And so this judge was on a case for this like abandoned building and the owner of the building, it being like a liability to the people of the city. So he like went to the building to inspect it and fell through a hole where a stairway used to be and died 4 days later from the head injuries that he inflicted or that were. It's not the right verbiage, but.
So I life is tragedy. Like I get it that there's probably a bit of like maybe just processing in writing this book.
Right.
And you know, the trauma that goes with investigating the homicide of a 15-year-old girl, especially that somebody is, you know,
mm-hmm.
truly, truly innocent. And, But again, the stories aren't really kind of woven through to make it interesting. Right. It's literally like this chapter is just stuck in there and like, oh yeah, this mm-hmm. judge died. And oh yeah, there's the guy that, the guy that turned them in and ended up getting arrested for the same thing. And so, yeah, it didn't flow real well to me.
Yeah.
To be honest, I'm not even really sure the point. I think that's probably true. You could like pick anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be bad things that happen to somebody that's about everything. So, yeah. And I don't know. We appreciate you if you're still hanging with us and listening to us. It's I almost feel like in some ways it's a disservice to the victim because it's not.
I thought about that a little bit, like when you started talking about how there's like no background
mm-hmm.
to Anne. Like it very much felt like they just kind of like brushed over what happened to her and then mm-hmm. focused on the justice or injustice that was done to Nunley and Taylor through their court trial. Yeah.
Well, and at one point when they're, and I can't remember which one is execution, it is the author is, I believe, in the room for one of the executions.
Mm.
And there's a group of people talking about like, you know, kind of almost having empathy for the guy that's about to be executed.
Yeah.
And the author kind of speaks up and goes, anybody wondering what Anne's last moments were like? Anybody thinking about the family right now?
Mm-hmm.
And the room, I guess, kind of goes silent. But again, just kind of my take on it. This to me is truly just one of the most horrific things, again, to have happen to you and to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to be a parent.
Yeah.
And have that happen. So this happens in 1989. Like I said, the cops, like with literally within like 3 months, have kind of suspects.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of July that summer, they have basically an arrest. Like they're moving forward with the case and these guys are going to get charged.
Mm-hmm.
They both plead guilty to their charges. They both agree to have a judge decide their sentence
instead
for them.
And a jury.
Yeah. So they decide not to go to jury trial. And
the reasoning for that was they thought they might have a better chance of not getting the death penalty if a judge decided instead of a jury. Did I understand that correctly?
So, yeah. So I think they both were hoping for a couple of different things. Yes, they clearly went judge shopping.
Mm-hmm.
So the judge that they got had never sent anybody to death row.
Yeah.
Or to the death penalty.
Yeah.
So that was their first thing was they were kind of hoping that the judge, they were going to get a judge that was not going to give them the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And then I think they both thought that they were going to testify against the other person. And so their sentence would be kind of commuted or be lighter, like saying he's the one that wanted her, that wanted to rape her. He's the one that killed her. He's the one. And again, this is good police work. This is a great example of most criminals are kind of idiots and don't plan their crime or don't do much. And mm-hmm. as you said, you know, they would like block out, they ditched the ashtray. They would like get rid of the light in the car. It was like they made more effort to cover up their crimes of stealing cars than they did of making an effort to.
Yep.
And even in that, like one of the things that they said that part of the reason why they said they tossed the ashtray out of the car was because of fingerprints or mm-hmm. like cigarette butts.
Yeah.
But yet they're touching everything in the car. So why are
those the things that, yeah.
Yeah. So this goes on for not just years, but decades. And when I say this goes on, good police work. They both confess. They both waive the right to a trial. The judge sentenced them to the death penalty. And that's when the appeals start. And mm-hmm. they both are trying to get out of mm-hmm. not being sentenced to death in the state of Missouri. And so it drags on until 2014 and 2015. And so Nunley was executed on September 1st, 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And then Taylor, it was in February of 2014, but I don't have the exact date on those.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so they both end up being executed, which we're seeing less and less actual people getting the death penalty. It's not quite as prevalent as it was. And to me, it's another reason why I'm not for the death penalty is mm-hmm. this dragged on for 26 years, 25 years, 26 years mm-hmm. for the family. And kind of we were discussing this earlier. What were your thoughts about the death penalty and the family and all that kind of perspective on everything?
Yeah, it took 20 plus years for the suspects to actually reach their execution date. And it just felt like at some point, like, why are you still putting the family through that? Like, they would go to the jail or the wherever the
execution. Yeah.
Yeah. Sit down and then be told
it's not happening.
It's not happening. Like multiple times.
Yeah.
And I think regardless of, because I learned this in the book, you have to be asked to come be a witness for an mm-hmm. execution.
Yeah.
And so that in and of itself, going through that is going to be emotional and traumatic. And so to have to like build yourself up to witness that and then be told it's not happening and then doing that over and over again.
For 25, 26 years.
For 25 years. And even more so being the witness that it, like that event happened to, mm-hmm. like they're being executed because you're a victim of their crime. Like that, I feel like would just add to the trauma instead of it being like an actual, like redeeming thing for them.
Yeah. And that's, I came to the same conclusion. Now, again, never been in this situation. Hope mm-hmm. I'm never not. And I can't imagine losing a child, particularly in that way. I do, and maybe somebody did this, but there's a part, like a big part of me that even if I was in that situation, I would want somebody to go, their death is not your closure.
Right.
Like your daughter is gone.
Mm-hmm.
There is no justice. Like the reality is there's just no justice in your child being abducted, raped, and murdered. Mm-hmm. And I get there's an element of closure. There's a get of, you know, kind of a fair punishment is for them to die for what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just think it's almost decades of torture waiting yeah. for that closure. And I would be curious to see if it brought the closure, if it brought any kind of
right.
justice to them that these guys were executed mm-hmm. or not. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, yeah. So check out the book if you're interested. It's called By the Side of the Road. Kind of one of those things of just being at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to me is always one of the more frightening things of just like, you know, yep. so often people have things happen to them because they're hanging out with the wrong people. They're making right. bad decisions. And this was just truly an innocent child going yep. to school and she got abducted. Very, very, very sad. You know, and I didn't totally want to go down this rabbit trail, but it just kind of, it entered my mind. So they talk about evil in this book, and that's the conversation that we have had.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about how evil, particularly I think Nunley was and mm-hmm. his behavior and all that kind of stuff. And so to me, this is evil.
Oh yeah.
But it's a different kind of evil than like what we talked about earlier in terms of like the torturing
right.
and keeping people tied up and doing that kind of stuff.
Right.
And to a certain degree, it really is almost more like stupidity
mm-hmm.
or ignorance or just right. like, so
yeah,
I don't know if you had anything that you wanted.
I think that's accurate what you said. Yeah.
All right. Well, we do appreciate you hanging with us on this one. It may have come through a little bit that we both weren't completely into this. And on top of that, we have three dogs in the room with us as we're recording and including a puppy. So if we seemed a bit distracted, thank you for going this far in the podcast with us. And we appreciate you, checking in week in, week out, or maybe it's month in, month out, yeah. Depending on the frequency with which we get our episodes to you. So, until next time, I'm Cop.
And I'm Daughter.
Stay safe.
To help find him, we should note for you, you may find his footage disturbing.